Good afternoon, and welcome to our fifth annual Rosenkranz debate. I want to express our gratitude to the Rosenkranz Foundation for supporting this event. We love having it as our Saturday, as the Saturday centerpiece for this convention. An intellectually sharp one-on-one debate between two highly prominent thinkers about law. This series had a wonderful start started in 2008 with a discussion between Judge Posner and then Judge McConnell. In 2009, we had Judges Guido Calabresi and Frank Easterbrook. In 2010, Professors Richard Epstein and William Eskridge. And last year, we have Paul Clement debating Larry Tribe on the healthcare case. To moderate this year's debate, I want to introduce Judge Thomas Griffith of the Court of Appeals, of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Judge Griffith was appointed to the court in 2005. Before that, among other things, he had served as Senate Legal Counsel and General Counsel of BYU. And on a personal level, I still remember visiting our BYU chapter and Judge Griffith's warm welcome, and I could actually say more about that, but I'll save that for another time. Judge Griffith.
Thank you. Well, I know why I was asked to do this. I have a watch. That's going to be my job today. And so we've decided beforehand that here are the rules of engagement. We're going to ask Hadley to speak for 20 minutes, and then Judge Kaczynski will speak for 20 minutes, and then Hadley will speak for 5 minutes, and Judge Kaczynski for 5 minutes, and then, as someone said, then the gloves come off. And then at that time, we'll turn it over to the audience to answer questions. So without that, without anything further,
thank you.
Take it away, Professor Arkin.
Does this microphone work? Yeah, okay. We can raise the money, but it'll be wrong for sure. Yeah.
And let's just do this. This is the last intervention. You want a 1 minute notice when we're up on 20 minutes?
Yeah, okay, something like that. Yeah.
Okay, are you Mark?
Tom has given me a minute of preliminary thanks. To thank Tom for doing this, to thank Nick Rosenkranz for the series that has engaged us all, and Alex for coming in to join me at the last moment. I've sent some of my very best students to Alex. I knew I was sending them to a teacher who's devoted, relentless, exacting, intractable. Good to give me that. And loving. We've been asked to do this at a time after the election when it's rather like entertaining at a shiva or a wake. I know many of us have been distracted. I've been busy looking at real estate in Malta. And the writer Joseph Epstein says he's had a hard time lately sustaining reflections, and he wished he had a pill to help him sustain reflections. But carrying a warning label, if you have a reflection lasting more than 4 minutes, you should have a number to call. Well, we have a large subject with the straits of time. I may have to use an old device of mine and compress this talk Hebraically by omitting the vowels. We gaunch now, Tom.
You're off.
Okay.
Go.
It's never out of season here to recall James Wilson's line that the purpose of this Constitution was not to invent new rights, but to secure and enlarge those rights we already had by nature. In radical contrast, Blackstone had famously said that when we enter civil society, we give up those unrestricted rights we had in the state of nature, including our liberty to do mischief, and we exchange them for a more diminished set of rights under civil society, call them civil rights, rendered more secure by the advent of a government that can enforce them. To which James Wilson said, when did you ever have a liberty to do mischief? When did you ever have a right to do a wrong? The laws that restrain you from raping and murdering have not deprived you of anything you ever had a right to do, even in the state of nature. And so when the question was raised at the beginning, what rights do we give up in entering civil society? The answer tendered by the Federalists was none. Hamilton said of the Federalist 84, here the people surrender nothing. In that case, what's the rationale for attaching a kind of codicil called a Bill of Rights, reserving all those rights we hadn't given up, unless you're implying that you had given up the bulk of your natural rights? Well, we invoke traditions here quite often, and I'm registered at this point just to indicate the tradition among us that I'm representing today with Hamilton and Wilson. In this setting, I shouldn't represent anything exotic. I'm here simply to sound positions we once used to hold. My friend Dan Robinson remarked that he wanted, when he died, this inscription on his tombstone, "He died without a theory." A former president of Amherst said, "Hadley has a theory of natural law, natural right." I said, when people say that, they rather imply they're standing back in wholesome detachment, watching theories whiz past, and somehow they're able to form judgments about the fragments of those theories that are plausible or implausible, true or false. And I said, take me back to the grounds on which you're making those judgments, but the things we can truly know in the domain of right and wrong, and you'd have arrived back at what some of us take to be the very ground of the natural law in the canons of reason, what Blackstone called the laws of reason and nature. And that first generation of jurists had a remarkable knack of tracing their judgments back to those anchoring axioms. So Hamilton would say in the Federalist 78, "We work under this rule of construction that any later statute supersedes an earlier one. But that's not the rule of construction we use with the Constitution, because the Constitution coming earlier must be able to override the statute coming later, or else it loses its function as a control on the legislative power." And he says, how do we know this? It's not part of the positive law of the Constitution. It's the reason and nature of the thing. Now, we may recall John Marshall at the end of Gibbons versus Ogden with a kind of throwaway line, apologizing to his readers for spending so much time demonstrating what should stand in the class of an axiom. He assumed that all of his literate readers out there knew that before we can carry out a demonstration, certain indemonstrables, things that we know per se know, to have to be in place, like the law of contradiction. If you didn't know it, we couldn't demonstrate it to you in a demonstration. These things had to be grasped per se nota. Hamilton gave us the most elegant account of that in the opening of Federalist 31. In disquisitions of every kind, there are certain primary truths or first principles upon which all subsequent reasonings must depend. These contain, he said, an internal evidence which, antecedent to all reflection or combination, commands the assent of the mind. We grasp the law of contradiction in the same way we grasp that it is senseless, even in this age of animal liberation, to sign labor contracts with our horses or dogs, or seek the informed consent of our household pets before we authorize surgery on them, but we continue to think that those beings who can give and understand reasons over matters of right and wrong deserve to be ruled with a rendering of reasons in a regime that elicits their consent. Well, once that critical point was put in place, we had the deepest principles of the American regime, that the security of the American people cannot be put in the hands of officers, whether in Westminster or in courts with unelected judges, officers who bear no direct responsibility to the people whose lives are at stake. That understanding, finding its deep ground in the natural law, tells us what is deeply wrong with the holding in the Beaumedienne case of bringing judges onto the battlefield. It also explains why unelected judges must work under far more restraint, with more severe discipline to cabin their judgments. I don't doubt for a moment that George Sutherland in the old Belmont case thought there was something deeply wrong with taking the assets held by Russian nationals in New York and transferring them to Stalin's government. But he knew that judges dare not interfere with matters of diplomatic recognition, which go hand in hand with military strategy. To take seriously again, the principles of natural law is not to license judges to float untethered from the text and from those principles that command their respect, even when they were not mentioned in the text. Now, part of the genius of the founding generation is they showed us how they could trace their judgments back to those anchoring principles, even not mentioned in the text, and start working under these constraints. And so in McCulloch versus Maryland, as you may recall, John Marshall said, you know, the Constitution gives the Congress the power to punish only piracies on the high seas. But if the Congress can establish mails, the power to establish must entail the power to preserve, in this case against theft. He draws the answer from the very logic of a law. If we have a national government, there must be the power to legislate at the national level. That case, and how would law be law if it were not binding and could not be enforced? But several years earlier, as you may remember, he did something far more elegant. In Fletcher versus Peck, he had a law in Georgia rescinding a granted lands, which he took to be the equivalent of impairing the obligation of a contract. He could have settled the matter then very easily by bringing it under the Contracts Clause, Article 1, Section 2. Instead, he did something far more elegant. He showed how the contracts clause could be drawn deductively with the force of a syllogism from that deeper underlying principle on ex post facto laws, one of those deep principles of lawfulness that will have to be part of any regime of law, and so he could come up with something quite striking. Georgia is a great state, part of the American empire. But even if Georgia were a separate sovereign state outside the Union, outside the Constitution, outside Article 1, Section 10, this law would still be wrong, because its wrongness is rooted in a proposition that does not depend at all for its validity on being mentioned in the text. Now, we fast forward, as we say these days, and I'm at Red Mass after lunch with a friend of many years, Antonin Scalia, talking about his fine opinion in the Heller case. I may say, for the record, since my friend has been on the court since 86, there is no one who has spoken my mind more often, more forcefully, and often better than my friend. And now I have Sam Alito. I said to Nino, I gather in the Heller case, you're appealing to a deep principle of self-preservation, but which I took you to mean the right of an innocent person to fend off an unjustified assault. He said, quite right. In which case, I was wondering, were you appealing to a deep principle? Those words are not in the text. Were you appealing to a deep principle that did not depend on this being mentioned in the text? Or were you saying Blackstone and Wilson said it and a lot of people read them at the time? Because if it's the latter, we may turn jurisprudence into legislative history. We find ourselves asking, how many people who voted to ratify the Second Amendment actually had read Blackstone and Wilson and had incorporated them in their judgments? And even if we got the answer to that question, it would not be the answer to the question we're asking. Is there, in fact, a deep principle that justifies people getting access to a lethal weapon for the sake of defending their lives and their freedom? Some of our friends appeal to history and tradition because they think it's fraught with less controversy, that it's easier to get agreement on the historical record, a point we've discovered to be quite manifestly untrue. It's hard to avoid the sense that for many conservatives, they appeal to history because they've actually lost their confidence that there is a discipline of reason that offers guidance and constraint to the judges. In their own way, they become children of David Hume. They've really come to think that the reason is but the instrument of the passions. And when a judge strikes down a law as being wrongful or unjustified, he really means to say he doesn't like it. And in that way, I'm afraid some of our friends have made of themselves operational relativists while being willing to conceal it to themselves. And the most striking example here comes with the cases on speech. What could be a clearer slogan of relativism than Justice Harlan's famous line from Cohen versus California, "One man's vulgarity is another's lyric," that there is no principal ground on which to distinguish offensive, assaulting speech from anything else. Justice Harlan thought he was bringing a fresh novelty to the law by injecting the logical positivism that was all the rage when he was an undergraduate, but injecting it about 30 years after it had been abandoned in the schools of philosophy. And the reasons for the abandonment could be seen in the incoherence of Harlan's own argument. You may recall that Mr. Cohen, in that case, was wearing a jacket with the inscription, pardon the expression, "fuck the draft." But Harlan asked, how is this word to be distinguished from any other word? The meaning of words was subjective. And yet Harlan was protecting the jacket as a species of political speech. But if all the words meaning of words was subjective, "fuck the draft" could mean "make love to the wind." Yet, don't count the laughs among my time. Yet Harlan knew that the speech was political because he knew that Cohen was condemning the draft. The words may alter, but the moral functions of commending and condemning must ever be in the language because they're part of our own makeup and nature. The words that carry those functions, they may shift from time to time, but at any given moment, we must know the words that are clearly carrying those meanings. Juries composed of ordinary folk have no trouble. You give them a list of things, say, libertarian premises. When in doubt, do not convict. But they have no trouble picking out from the words that are really unambiguously now terms of assault or derision. You give them a list. Kike bastard, wop, urologist, meter maid, that's a tough one in Washington, saint, right? Nor do people have trouble telling the difference between a burning shoebox and a burning cross. These are not inscrutable problems, but my point is that the very ground for answering them is built into the very logic of language. The law that recognized these critical points in the old Chaplinsky case was a law grounded in certain truths about nature that could not be effaced. And the court recognized that it could sustain bans on gross assaulting words or gestures without impairing in the least the freedom of people to make the most scathing, searching, searing, substantive arguments. Yet by absorbing these lines of argument from the Cohen case, some of our favorite judges have persuaded themselves that a burning cross could not be judged and barred as an act of assault, for that would judge the content of the message being conveyed. And with the same premises in place, and over the dissent of Justice Alito, the court insisted that the law could do nothing to restrain or shunt from the scene the Reverend Phelps and his gang as they harassed the funeral of a dead Marine with signs saying, "Semper Fi, fags, and thank God for dead soldiers." In the past, the cops working with the common sense of Chaplinsky would have shooed them off the scene. And even more recently, in the Stolen Valor case in Alvarez, Justice Kennedy began with a presumption against making judgments on the content of speech, and with that anchoring premise in place, he would bar the law from forbidding those people who use their speech to represent themselves falsely as the recipients of military honor. Again, Justice Alito was in dissent, and Judge O'Scanlan had raised the question of when there was ever a constitutional right to lie. Was that line of Robert Jackson's, that no liberty is rendered more secure by teaching that its practice is inseparable from its abuse? And yet this species of relativism seems to be absorbed as wisdom now, even by some of our friends, as a species of conservative jurisprudence. In some respects, we're all originalists. There are varieties of originalism. I raised the question to Scalia about Lyman Trumbull, the 14th Amendment, and interracial marriage. But I, too, study Hamilton, Marshall, the founders. I stand with Richard Epstein, John Eastman, Randi, Clarence Thomas, in holding that the Commerce Clause should be scaled back to something closer to its original meaning before it was transformed during the New Deal. Justice Story used to invoke that old maxim outside the text: what may not be done directly may not be done indirectly. If it's wrong for you to kill Jones, it's wrong for you to hire someone to kill Jones. And if the federal government may not establish the wages at the Hoosac Mills in North Adams, Massachusetts, it may not do it indirectly by extending the tax and offering to remit it if the plant accepts the federal policy. As Owen Roberts says, they were asking us to buy back our freedom. And now we have another Roberts, John, insisting that there's no way, even under the Commerce Clause, as we know it, that individuals can be compelled to buy medical insurance, but we can accomplish the same thing indirectly through the tax system, using taxes as a penalty. The old alarms and whistles. The old alarms and whistles should have gone off, but somehow we no longer hear them. Even the conservative judges in our own day persistently move beyond the text, but with little awareness that they're doing it, as in the recent Obamacare with Roberts and the dissenters. But in earlier time, not all that long ago, judges like George Sutherland understood they were doing it, and they did it with a certain discipline. And what Sutherland did mainly was to draw the axioms that arise out of respecting the difference between innocence and guilt and extracting the procedures that will be in place before we visit punishment on people. But at the same time, a law that draws its principles in that way will recognize all the sooner that nothing in that chain of reasoning can possibly tell judges the right number of divisions in breaking up AT&T, the right price for a pair of pants, the standards that govern wage price controls, or with our friend Janice Rogers Brown in the recent Hind-Hedinger case, these principles will not tell us why it is wrong for the Hind-Hedinger company to market milk at 20 cents less a gallon in Southern California, or why that affair should constitute, quote, a disorderly market condition that the law has any business in barring. We used to have available in the logic of natural rights the language readily used by judges to protect ordinary people and their freedom to earn their living at a legitimate calling. It was the kind of language used by George Sutherland when he went to the aid of Willie Lyons trying to run an elevator at the Congress Hotel at a wage her employers were quite willing to pay and she was quite willing to accept, when he struck down that paternalistic law on minimum wages for women. One of the differences of his days and ours, that the conservatives will say these measures are bad for entry-level jobs, and Sutherland would explain to us why these measures were wrong in principle, even if you could want to claim at any time that they worked. I would draw as a final example here one of the most serious differences among friends on the conservative side, the jurisprudence of abortion. Why has the assumption settled in so deeply among our favorite conservative judges that the most the Supreme Court can do on abortion is overturn Roe versus Wade and send the matter back to the states? I, too, would like to see the matter sent back to the states, and gradually it's being done. But is that all we can really say? From the perspective of those who see the matter through the lens of natural law, the question is, what is the ground of principle on which the law may remove a whole class of human beings from the circle of rights-bearing beings subject to the protections of the law? We shift the label. They're not people. They're niggers. They're not persons. They're fetuses. I've mused in print over the problem of what the judges would have done if the understanding had settled in quite early that those Civil War amendments were really meant to cover only those blacks who had become human. Because after all, we've been told that not everything conceived by humans is humans at all stages. And some of our friends on the court say, we cannot tell when human life begins any more than the first 9 names in the telephone directory. So we send the matter back to the states, and the states conceive a color wheel. You become more human as you become lighter in complexion. Does anyone here think that the judges in our own day would have no questions to raise if the states decided that children were more human as they were lighter in complexion, scored higher on verbal tests? We know that the judges have the modes of argument readily at hand to identify grounds that were thoroughly arbitrary in making these discriminations between the human and the not human, between those whose lives may be taken, may be protected, and those whose lives may be taken without even the need to render a justification. Why then should we suppose that judges in our own day would encounter an inscrutable problem if they found humans in the womb put outside the protections of the law in the states because of their height or weight, because they're lacking limbs or hadn't acquired yet the facility of speech and doing syllogisms? Why then, we have to ask, have some of the most accomplished judges talk themselves into the notion that something in the scheme of jurisprudence sort of bars them from raising that kind of a question of principle that pierces to the core of those rights and those persons that the Constitution was meant to protect? I go to my finish. Justice Scalia has referred to that right to bear arms, the right of an innocent person to protect himself, as a pre-existing right which was there before the Constitution. He might say with others of our friends that the Second Amendment was meant to secure that natural right. Other friends say that we can consider parts of the Constitution as meant to protect natural rights when we find something in historical record to confirm that understanding of the founders. But that rule itself, that the Constitution may protect only those natural rights we had some evidence to think that the founders sought to protect, that rule itself is nowhere to be found in the positive law of the Constitution. How then do we claim to know it? What's the ground in which we regard it as authoritative? I think our friends have backed into this rule because they think that it's something sensible in itself, as Hamilton would say, something we grasp per se nota, something which, antecedent to all reflection or combination, commands the assent of the mind, which is to say, they have backed into the logic of a first principle attached to the underlying natural law. As with that character in Molière, it turns out that they've been speaking prose all their lives. The simple truth is that they keep falling into the natural law because they've never left it. They are, as they are, never far from the natural law, and even in exotic places and cultures, even in the Ninth Circuit. It will always be with them. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Arcus, for moving us from broadcast to cable.
I have 2 oatmeal boxes and a very long string.
Okay. With that, we'll turn the time over to Judge Kaczynski for your 20 minutes.
Thank you.
Tell me when you want the clock to start. You get a couple of, you get some.
Oh, that's okay.
Okay, start.
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to need the 20 minutes because I'm persuaded.
No, you can't be persuaded. We've got to do this shtick. I told you. He always finds something to do that day.
Okay. Anyway, I thank you all for coming, and thank the Federal Society and Nick for arranging this forum. And I may be the wrong guy to be here opposing my good friend Hadley, because I have a lot of sympathy for his position. For one thing, I'm a textualist, and if you read the Bill of Rights, the Ninth Amendment talks about reserving rights to the people. So obviously, what it actually says is the enumeration of certain rights does not preclude other rights that the people might have. So being a textualist, primarily, I am a little bit knowledgeable of history. I realize that the Founding Fathers were very much a number of them were very much in the mold of natural law, believers in natural law. So I am tempted, at least I am interested in the subject, and I think it's very important, the work that Hadley is doing in trying to explore the limits of natural law and the contours. I think this is very important work to be done. Because I think there is also something, aside the constitutional side, I think there is something fundamentally right about Hadley's approach in that if we think of ourselves as human beings and if we think of ourselves where we are in existence, there's something that seems right about the idea that we have rights that are newer to us by nature of who we are and what we are. So I am tempted. So my mission here today is to raise a little skepticism about the contours of what we're talking about, and perhaps suggest some caution and point out maybe some of the dangers of the approach. Not because I'm opposed to it, but because I think it's important to be careful what you wish for. You might get more of it than you want. I also feel a little bit like Obama in Denver, sort of a little tongue-tied, and I'm not sure I'm going to do such a good job here, but I'll do my best. There are a couple of problems that I want to talk about at the outset. One of them is, first of all, the natural rights regime is based on a theory that somehow we came out of a state of nature, then brought with us certain rights, and now that we've been in society, we don't give up those rights. Well, the reality, of course, is there never was a state of nature. This is just not history. This is really philosophy. And there was never a time when we're out there in a state of nature, devoid of society. Human beings have always lived in societies of sorts. So this is really more of a theoretical concept. It's also a concept that changes over time. So first of all, we have to have some agreement as to, since we don't have any real history of what the state of nature was, it's a construct, we have to start with some sort of agreement as to what those rights were that we had in that theoretical state that never existed, which itself gives a lot of room for play. And having hung around judges for a long time, I must say that when you give judges play, you're taking a life in your hands. So I think we need to be careful there. We also have to realize that over time, this idea of the state of nature does change, or idea of what those natural rights are, what is natural, has changed and will change and must change. Let me just give you two very simple examples. If you just to cast your mind back to the time that the Constitution was adopted, the Bill of Rights was adopted, the right to vote, the right to participate in the political process, which today I think one would say should be the right of every adult human being, was limited to white men. Women were not allowed to participate. People of color, Indians, blacks, were not allowed to participate. Not even all white men, you had to, in many places, you had to be propertied. And the idea that people who didn't have a house, who didn't have property, would participate in the political process was thought of to be heresy, or people of color or women would vote. Now, I don't think anybody in this room, or any very many people in society today, would say that, suggest that it's not a natural right of citizenship to be able to vote, to participate in your political process. Never mind what the Constitution said. Never mind what the courts have said. That regardless of all those things, I think we all agree that being an adult human being, regardless of sex or race, if you're a citizen, you are entitled to participate in the political process. That aspect of our view of what is natural has changed. Think about the internet. I mean, when we're talking about the founding fathers, they would have thought, oh yes, the right to speak freely, the right to stand on a street corner on a soapbox, or whatever the kind of boxes they had in those days, to run a press. Those, I think, would have been thought by most founding fathers to be a natural right. Somebody would say, "Well, George, you know, what did you think of, or James, you know, what did you think of the internet? You know, do you think there's a right to blog?" And they would have said, "Huh?" And you know, obviously, these things evolve, and it's not just a question of technology. I mean, technology changes the way we relate to each other, and the way we communicate, and the way we participate in the community and in the political process. So that is a problem, and it's an issue that has to be thought about. The idea that there is not some fixed notion of natural rights that existed then and that we somehow sort of apply today. It does evolve over time, and it must evolve over time, just like in many ways our constitutional interpretation evolves over time. And then finally, there's the question of what happens when natural rights, or what we think to be natural rights, clashes with things that are actually affirmatively in the Constitution. I mean, there's a provision in there, for example, that says you have to be a natural-born citizen to be president. And, you know, I don't know, it doesn't feel natural to me. I mean, let's take, just as an example, somebody who came to the United States, let's just say 50 years ago, in like, let's say, December of 1962. From Romania, and who has participated in the political process for much longer than more than half of the United States, people in the United States, because I've been here for, watches the election process and says, you know, these Americans haven't done such a great job with nominating their candidates. Isn't there a natural right to participate in the political process after having been here that long to actually be able to run for president? Now, I think it's a debatable right, and you've run up against a positive prohibition in the Constitution. What do you do if somebody makes a claim like that does seem to have some natural appeal to it, but it runs up against a constitutional prohibition? So just by way of debate, just to open the debate and to give us something to discuss, let me make the natural law case for three rights that I think or make the case for what I think that one could make for three rights that are somewhat controversial these days. I will talk about the right to same-sex marriage, the right to abortion, and the right to health care. And I'm not going to speak of any particular health care provision, just the right to have a socially paid health care. And how would one make the right, let's say the right to same-sex marriage, how would one make a natural law right case for that? Well, we'd say, well, natural law is, it is natural for individuals to join with another adult, one adult to join with another adult, to form a household, to share a life, and to raise children and live a life together, faithful to each other and friends and share how, you know, share a life in a household together. And people would actually say, well, but you know, it's always been a man and a woman, but one would say, well, that's an accident of history. That happens to be because technology only allowed men and women to have children if they had children together historically. But now we have many other ways. We have in vitro fertilization, we have adoption, we have many other ways in which people can have children. And we do have children that are not necessarily their product of their union. We don't prohibit people from marrying because they are past childbearing age, even if they're men and women. We don't prohibit people, we don't check up on people and see how often they have sexual relations. We don't tell them, now you got to get a divorce because you no longer have sexual relations often enough. We leave those kind of decisions to the partners themselves to decide. And yes, it is true, historically it has been the case that people have married each other in the opposite sexes, but it used to be that people only married people of the same religion and people of the same race. And that was an accident to somewhat of history, and we've gotten past that, just like we got past the idea that we only have white males voting. We now accept the fact that people vote of different races. We now accept the idea that people of different races can marry each other. Why not? What impediment is there to people of opposite sex marrying? That would be the case, and that becomes me to talk about. Let me talk about abortion now. Hadley talked about the right of self-preservation, and he made a very good case, I thought, for the idea that a fetus is a person and should be treated as a person. But of course, if a person attacks you, you're entitled to preserve yourself. And here's the case, and this is, again, this is not my view, but I'm putting it forth just to suggest ways in which natural law can be used in various ways. And one of them would be to say, look, I'm a woman, I have my body, and this human being, this other person is attacking me. Is depending on me for food, sustenance. I have to carry it around for 9 months. I am impaired in what I can do. Sometimes impairs my health. And this is, you know, I have no obligation to that. I mean, let's say, for example, you had a neighbor who was on a heart-lung machine. And one, you know, turns out it's very expensive to run in terms of electricity. And one day you found out that he'd been plugged into your garage using your electricity. Would you have a right to unplug it and say, hey, listen, I don't have to pay for your treatments? I would argue that you would. Would not be a kind thing to do. I think would be but you would have a right. Or let's see, for example, and make a situation that's a little more acute. My father spent many years in a concentration camp. I am here because he's a Holocaust survivor. I happen to be here because he survived. And he survived because he managed to get enough food to get him past those terrible times. What if he had seen somebody trying to steal his bread that he needed to survive, that kept him alive? Would he have been entitled to smite that person or attack that person? I would say that probably so. I think that when it's a question of your own life and your own body, you have some rights to self-preservation. What do you do about the case of a woman who says, I don't dispute that the fetus is a human being. If it can live on its own outside my body, that's perfectly fine. But so long as it's attacking my body and asking demands of me, I am entitled to get rid of it. Again, this is not my view. I'm just telling you what could be done with theories of natural rights. Let's talk about healthcare. When I was in college, there was Rawls was not Liu. This is John Rawls. Was a very much read, and I don't know how many of you here have read Rawls. But his theory was that as a matter of justice, as a matter of how we ought to order our lives, we ought to imagine that we start not knowing what gifts we have been given at birth. You don't know whether you're going to be a rich person or a poor person, whether you're going to be smart or stupid, whether you're going to have wealth or talent or beauty or anything else. And the question is, how would you order yourself in that state? How would you order society in a state where you don't know where they come out? You might come out on top, you might come out at the bottom. And his theory was, and I never bought into it, I was more of a nosy kind of guy, but many people did. And he said that what you would do in that situation, and what a rational thing to do in that situation, is to arrange society in a way, not knowing where you wind up, that we are all bound together at the ankle, and that we all are responsible for each other's basic needs. Now, as best I can tell, and again, you Hadley will accuse me of being like Justice Harlan, looking at philosophers 30 years out of vogue, but these things have a way of, philosophy has a way of sticking around and making it doesn't go away. And I think many people still believe very much in the Rawlsian notion. And one would say, okay, there are certain things that you need, and one of them is healthcare. And we as a society then ought to have a natural right, never mind the question of whether this is done by Congress, or whatever, but you have a natural right entitlement to have your healthcare paid for by society, shared, where you share in the costs and then you share in the benefits. Now, I think there are very good answers to these, to all of these cases I've made, but my concern is that these are the kinds of debates you would get into. And unlike the Constitution and laws where you actually have some text, I know federal judges are not supposed to look at text too much, but Judge Baer and Judge O'Scanlan and I occasionally manage to catch a glimpse, a glance here and there, despite the rules. But at least you have you have some text to guide you. The problem with natural law is that it is so oriented, and I think that's why I believe Justice Scalia may reject it, and I don't want to put words in anybody else's mouth, but why I am skeptical of it is because it gives such wide berth to debates, and that it is possible to construct all manner of arguments depending ultimately on what in your gut you feel is the right and just thing to do. And I think in a society where courts have immense powers, and where judges are, at least in the federal system, not elected and serve for life, I think we ought to be very careful, and I think we ought to be very chary of giving such power to a few hundred men and women to change our lives. I think it is a worthwhile project. I think it is a project that we ought to give serious thought to, but first and foremost, I think we ought to be exceedingly cautious. Okay. Thank you very much.
Now I have 5 minutes of response from Professor Arcus.
Well, as a colleague of mine says, I think we're in heated agreement. look, we see a sign saying 35 mph, 70 mph. There's nothing of moral significance about those signs, but Kant would remind us that behind any law is a natural law that tells us why we're justified in having a law in the first place, some deeper principle about driving at speeds that put innocent life at hazard. And we have to make a transition to regulations of the positive law. We may have a deep principle that James Wilson's first deep principles, that we don't hold people blameworthy for acts they were powerless to effect. Now, that deep principle would be engaged in the insanity defense, many other things. We will still argue about, was this person really in control of himself? We can have many arguments about these things. The things that are not changing are the underlying principles themselves. We can argue about the franchise. George Sutherland striking down the law for minimum wages in the District of Columbia. Is that Alex knows, he reviewed my book. He was a leader in the cause of votes for women. And in that cause, they had on their side that deep principle of government by consent. So the burden of argument had to go to the other side. The Constitution is a structure. Somebody says, do you care about the text? Yes, I want to know who succeeds when the president dies in office. There are many things I want to know. Yes, I'm maybe 35 years old, and I wish Alex could run for president. But I'm willing to take these things. This is a structure. It's very important that we have a structure. And one of the traditions of the positive law is that statesmen at times will have to make an accommodation with an evil for the sake of compressing it. And that's why we had the Fugitive Slave Clause, because the recognition was we're not going to be able to obliterate all evils, as Aquinas taught. You can just have to compress evils to tractable dimensions. And so I remember, Justice Curtis points out in Dred Scott that the Fugitive Slave Clause is cast in terms of positive law, people held to service under labor under the laws of their states. You have the old line, this is so bad that it could be sustained only by the positive law. But notice the scheme here, when we have the disagreements, no one says here you're not going to have disagreements about applying those principles and applying them to cases. We're going to have many serious arguments, but notice the coin is going to be over the reasons we give. On that matter of abortion, I think I've simply taken the example of principled reasoning offered by Lincoln in that famous fragment he wrote, imagining himself involved in the debate with a slave owner. Why do you make a slave of the black man? He's less intelligent than you, but beware, the next white man who comes along more intelligent than you may enslave you. Is he darker? Ah, the next white man who comes along with a complexion even lighter than yours may enslave you. At no point was there an appeal to revelation or faith. It's just simply a model of principled argument. There's nothing you could cite about the black man that would not apply to many whites as well. And some of us simply have taken the same principled argument about abortion without appealing to faith. Why is that offspring in the womb less than human? Doesn't speak yet? Neither do deaf mutes. Lacks arms or legs? Other people lose arms or legs in the course of their lives without losing anything necessary to their standing as human beings to receive the protections of the law. So we could argue about all of these things as we apply them. On the matter, in the matter of same-sex marriage, take it another way. I remember a lawyer arguing before our friend Scalia, and I remember Nino was just bearing down on him. And he said, Mr. Justice Scalia, I want to appeal to my constitutional right to be presumed innocent. I said, oh, really? Where's that in the Constitution? Is that in there somewhere? Now, if I ask Nino about this, he says, it's the tradition of the common law that we've all drawn. Really? How about some of my old favorite writs, like, as James Wilson say, what about the great writ, De Heretico Comburendo, the writ to specify the burning of a heretic? And Wilson says, we don't do that anymore, right? Why don't we do that anymore? Why do we think presumed innocent is there, not merely because it's part of the tradition, but because there are compelling reasons to support it? Okay, my pitch then is, yeah, we're in the same game. And the thing is, as we try to work out the arguments, I think we'll find we're not appealing to tradition, not appealing to Pythagoras who said it, but finally trying to understand the reasons that would finally justify one outcome rather than another.
Thank you.
I'll pass.
Okay.
As ever, I'm with Alex. Right.
No, I think Hadley has defined it correctly. I think this is the debate. He hasn't had Steve Reinhardt as a colleague.
I give you that one.
So I maybe have a little more of an insight of what might be done with some of these arguments.
You know the condition of that Homo sapiens we have to deal with, right?
I think I know the full extent of the problem. So I'll pass.
Okay. You know, we could do a Sesame Street kit for him, you know. It's like one of these things is not like the other, you know. You build up from premises, Alex.
Maybe next year you'll have him here for the debate. He'll give you a demonstration.
I know. Now, I'm looking around. I'm going to, in just a second, open the floor to questions. Handheld microphone. Now, who has the handheld microphone? Okay, here's right here. So if you would make yourself known to one of these gentlemen here, but I'm going to exercise the prerogative of asking the first question, if that's all right. And it's going to go to Professor Arcus, but you're more than welcome to weigh in. So from an originalist point of view, isn't the fundamental we're talking about what is a judge supposed to do with concept of the natural law? How is a judge supposed to use the natural law in resolving a dispute? Wait, okay. And the originalists would look to Article 3 and say, what was the judicial power that's being described there? And I think there's little question that the framers had in mind something like a common law judge at the time, but they created a structure.
Right.
A structure that really left no room for this type of judge that you're talking about, didn't they? Didn't they create a structure? I mean, the common law judge that you're describing comes out of a different time and a different place. He was an agent of the crown, also had legislative capacities. But the judges that they created, it's a new type of judge, never been before seen. A judge that comes out of a notion of separated powers. So didn't they possibly have in mind judges with wigs and robes, but they created a structure in which there was no oxygen for such a judge to exist?
Well, you know,
The very reasons that Judge Kaczynski pointed out, because of the uncertain nature of this, what's going to happen in your system is you're going to have judges who are going to be deciding cases based on their deeply held view of what's right and wrong, and you'll have no way to break the ties.
Well, first of all, as Mike Griever points out, even after the Erie case, there is a kind of federal common law as judges keep appealing to some deep principles not in the text. My God, in the Obamacare case, John Roberts was appealing to some principle to say why unelected judges should bend over backwards to avoid interfering with something elected passed by the people's representatives. And my friends on the other side were saying, yes, that is right, but to respect what they've done, you shouldn't rewrite the statutes they've written. They're both appealing to some deep principle that's not in the text, and we think one of construction may be more plausible than the other. Look, about originalism, there are many things on this point. Listen, I look at Michael McConnell's and other interesting work about the meaning of the Establishment Clause. I think the original meaning. I take it to mean, yes, that the federal government may not interfere with the establishments in the separate states. So Rehnquist, Byron White would say, yes, we would sustain state governments giving more aid to religion, or we'd be willing to sustain a policy in which they give no aid at all, box it out. Okay, then we get young Josh Davey litigating in Washington, and Bill Rehnquist is willing to say, I'm following the original understanding. Washington has made clear it wants a further separation. But now, then Scalia is in dissent. Okay, even given that original meeting, what you have, you're creating disqualification based solely on his choice of a religious vocation. There's a religious disqualification there. So I gather Scalia could be saying, even with the original meeting, which I understand to be there, it doesn't foreclose further argument about the restrictions that are justified or unjustified.
My question is more the original meaning doesn't leave much room for the type
of judge. What do you have in mind, Tom? give me an example of it.
I'll pass. I guess, well, no, it's actually the examples Judge Kaczynski gave. What is going to be the principle that you're going to use to distinguish the cases that he's talked about? Because people are going to have deeply held views drawing upon their conception of natural law for any of these issues. If you're looking for some principle that you say is extra-textual, not in the Constitution, what's the judge going to use to find that? And do you really want a state in which you have unelected judges making those sorts of determinations?
Well,
aren't we safer in a state where we have judges who are tied to expressions of value in the text of the Constitution?
Again, I'm not an Ossoff, but simply point out the natural rights argument is not a right in which you concentrate the power solely in the judiciary. The point is that, as with Marbury versus Madison, you know, if a president of the United States is faced with a bill that would provide for the conscription only of members of a minority race, he's not confined to the utilitarian question of whether it would work. He too would be obliged to raise the question of whether this is compatible with the fundamental principles of the Constitution. When we did the Defense of Marriage Act, we were trying to give guidance to the courts about what they could do, giving guidance to the courts when they're going to face the question of whether a state would be obliged to honor the same-sex marriage coming in from another state. Because we thought that Congress should be able to cast a judgment here, giving its own moral judgment on that matter. And we're doing the hearings. Barney Frank leaned in and said, I think this whole thing is constitutional. I said, Congressman Frank, you make our very point. We think that's a judgment that the judges will make as well. that Congress has to make it. Well, so far, it's not confined simply to judges.
Oh, sure, but that's okay. where it's more interesting.
Okay, but the point is, look, we have people arguing fiercely.
I mean, where it really matters is judges, right? I mean, that's where the tire hits the road. That's where your theory of natural rights causes angst and concern amongst your co-originalists.
Yeah, but I think it, look.
I'm not going to ask.
Okay.
No, let's turn to questions.
Oh, I'm Roger. Okay. But
I see you have had some similar experiences to my own.
No comment about that.
Okay. Look out. Who's
it? We got Barnett and Pilon. You got anyone else has questions? Right here. This
over here.
Is right here.
Who's
first?
Who's first?
We'll get to you all.
Don't just pick on the good-looking speakers.
Sorry, Michael Hannon, NYU. Judge Kaczynski, I'm about to raise a critique or at least a challenge to some of the things you just articulated, but I wanted to concur with Professor Arkus that I also wish that you were able to run for president. So I guess I have a question about precisely what we mean by this term natural law that we're throwing around and that's kind of serving as the foundation here. Because it seems to me that we're conflating a few different typical meanings of the way we use the word natural in the English language. On the one hand, you talk about natural insofar as it means kind of what's typical for men, and particularly typical in a particular place and time, and we get at that with these kind of changing voting rights. There's also the use of the word natural by which we mean something like instinctual, and that goes to the Judith Jarvis Thompson abortion example that you give, or the same-sex marriage, sodomitical kind of natural urges example that you give. But I think what Professor Arkus and what the natural law tradition in general is getting at isn't natural in the sense of normal by way of typical or instinctual, but has to do with natural in the sense of what human nature is and kind of practical reasonableness in light of the kinds of beings that we are. And I guess my concern with Judge Griffith, some of the things that you're raising by way of very correct judicial restraint principles here, is that natural law in that sense, in the sense of just right reasonableness, is not something that we actually are even capable of excluding from the conversation. Judge Kaczynski, in your great opinion in Trident, you appeal to it with regards to language, even if not by name, in trying to say why, on the face of things, we have to presume that the words of these particular statutes and cases are understood by the people for whom they're promulgated. That's precisely the kind of reasoning that I think has to go on in these cases, and my fear is that whether or not we use the term natural law, by not bringing that kind of reasoning to the forefront, that we necessarily have to take to the texts themselves in order to understand and apply them, it's going to sneak its way in the back door and in really pernicious ways. So I was wondering, Professor Arkus, if you could just comment a little on what you mean by the natural law that you're defending here, and then comment from the others as well.
I recommend my book. Me too.
I recommend his book.
Constitutional Illusions.
Constitutional Illusions, the chapter on natural law. What the common sense of the thing was, you see with Lincoln, the certain rights that are grounded in the nature of human beings, rights that would be the same in all places where that nature was the same. And if it was really wrong to rule human beings as though they were horses and dogs, that same argument would be in place anywhere in the world where that same nature was in place. But it's not simply the things that people... we've had some judges who argue that infanticide must be in accord with the natural law because it seems to be an intractable part of the human record, and therefore it springs from something planted deeply in human nature. See, that's a deep confusion. The natural law has always had a sense of what is higher and lower in human nature. Remember Lincoln appealing to those better angels of our nature, right? Didn't you have a question for Alex?
Well, I agree with that. The devil is in the details. I mean, you know, for example, you would say, Yes, if you are in a society, it is natural for people to participate. You have a natural law right to participate in the political process. I would say. Then the question becomes, whom does it apply to? Does it apply to everybody? Does it apply to babies? Does it apply to immigrants? At least not until they've been here for long enough to become citizens. It doesn't apply it may not apply to prisoners. It may not apply to a bunch of... So we have that debate. Does it apply to people of different color? Does it apply to people of different sex? So the same thing about marriage. You could say, well, you could sort of say there's a natural law, right, that transcends everything to have a man and a woman living together, but that's just a question of the level of generality you want to define the right, in which you define the right. You could just say two people, not six people or eight people or three people and a giraffe. It is two people, and we can observe that in history and throughout the world. It tends to be two people, usually a man and a woman, often two people of the same sex, not unfrequently. I think you have a follow-up, but I don't...
There's a friend of mine, reporter from Denver, of a man who showed up at the marriage license bureau getting a marriage license for himself and his horse. And I'm pleased to tell you that I did guess the reason brought forth by the teller for refusing the license, which was the horse wasn't yet 18.
Roger.
In dog years, it was 57.
Good, Roger, and then
Roger
Pilo.
Alex, the devil.
Won't you
is,
stand up so people can see?
Okay,
you.
The devil is indeed in the detail, but because in some cases the details are difficult, doesn't mean the judge can absent himself from engaging.
We have a hard time hearing you.
Oh, okay. All right. Let me then go to the question. You began your remarks with an appeal to text, calling yourself a textualist, and you concluded. And you began with the text of the Ninth Amendment, and you concluded by appealing again to text because the absence of text gives a judge too much license, and this is a very common argument that we hear. But let's remember that we did live for 2 years without a Bill of Rights, and therefore it raises the question, what is...
There were horrible years.
Oh, yes.
And he remembers them.
He was close to them. Well. Yeah. And so what was a judge to do? You could say, well, the judge is to appeal to the doctrine of enumerated powers, and the logic being that where there is no power, there is a right, and that will get you just a certain ways down the road, but eventually... You're going, because those powers are very broad in some respects, you're going to have to appeal to kind of fundamental principles that Hadley spoke about in order to do the work of a judge right, engaged in the work of judicial craftsmanship. And just because it is difficult, as you said, and just because you do have to deal with details, doesn't mean that you can absent yourself from the project. Indeed, this is the old common law judges had simply the notions of property and contract largely to work with as they developed the theory of rights over 500 years. And this is the kind of thing that in many cases you have to do. Otherwise, you are ignoring the text of the Ninth Amendment, which says, as you didn't spell it out fully, that the enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. You can't retain what you don't first have to be retained. If you're going to take that text seriously, you've got to determine which rights are retained and which are not. You've got to engage in the kind of first principles that Hadley has spoken about. Otherwise, you're simply ducking the issue.
Well, I mean, that's the tension. I think we have a text that alludes to these rights, but let me just dispel the notion that you can't be a judge in any meaningful sense without some sort of spelling out of rights. Most places in the world don't have rights that are enforceable, many of our rights that are enforceable judicially. Most countries, rights are accorded by the legislature. And I communicate with judges from all over the world, and there's nothing that astonishes them more than the idea that we have a First Amendment, that actually there's a constitutional right to speak, and that the legislature can't tamper with it, even when it's really important, really, really important, because the speech is really dangerous or hurtful, you know, or involves disparagement of people's dignity. Carlos is on the same listserv with me, and he's seen some of his comments. Carlos Baer, my colleague. And it is just totally astonishing. I mean, yet we have judges from places like Scotland, England, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and not exactly pits of dictatorship. I mean, these are countries that have a freedom tradition just like we do. And yet, judges do not, in those countries, view themselves as empowered to sort of read rights into the body of the law. They rely on legislatures to do it. It's another way of doing it. I don't think it's a good way of doing it. I don't think it's a better way of doing it than we're doing it. But I do think that if you look honestly at our history of rights creation and rights interpretation over the last 200 years, it is not an unmitigated plus. I mean, there are many rights that judges have simply created out of whole cloth. Some rights that I personally like, that you might not like, and vice versa. But there's a lot of stuff in there that our judges, over the years, and we've adopted them and absorbed them, and you know we sort of view them as being more or less established. But they are simply not written down anywhere. And would we be better off broadening that? Would we be better off as a society creating an engine for creating more of that stuff? I don't know. I mean, I guess if I could pick the judges, I feel pretty good about doing it. But, you know, I keep seeing what happens out there in the elections, and I get less secure about that prospect.
Adley.
Bob, our friend Bob Bork had a case involving sculpture, and he wanted to establish a First Amendment right for the sculptor. Now, under the First Amendment was meant for political speech. It was a stretch to do that. But it was not a stretch with the original understanding. What Theodore Sedgwick said, why do you need an amendment on, why did you doubt that in a regime of freedom you have the right to speak and publish? Why don't you specify my right to get up in the morning, my right to walk down the street? The premises here in the original Constitution is that you have moral agents have a presumptive claim to all dimensions of their freedom. And the burden would have to fall to the government to establish the grounds of justification for restricting it. Now, when we're talking about voting, notice the part in voting that you weren't calling into question. You're assuming that this principle of government by consent, that it is not rightful to rule human beings the way we rule dogs and horses. Well, you need a certain competence for voting. Tests by race may be illegitimate. Maybe tests of maturity. The courts have sustained tests for literacy. An upright record. Maybe it's decided people with criminal records should not be in a position to make laws for others. There are many things we can argue about, but notice the part of the problem, the question that is not being called into question, the deep principle that would enjoin us to have a regime of voting. Can I just throw one other thing? I'm assuming here that even with the judge is still cabined by what I take to be the Lincolnian constraints that are bearing in judge. Remember in the Dred Scott case, Lincoln said, if the Supreme Court decides Dred Scott to be a slave, we're not going to form a mob and free him. We can confine that case to the holding in that case, and we are not obliged to act on some other principle, on that principle, and anything that comes under our hand. And you may remember the first days of the Lincoln administration, they had a petition from a black inventor in Boston, a black student denied a passport to study in France because the State Department had decided that under Dred Scott, blacks may not be citizens, therefore they may not carry passports. And a black inventor was denied a patent because under Dred Scott again, he's not a citizen, he can't have a patent in the United States. Remember, Edward Bates quashed both those decisions. Whatever's in Dred Scott, in the understanding of this administration, any black person born free in the United States is a citizen of the United States, Dred Scott notwithstanding. We'll simply confine that case to the two litigants. What you had here were instances of branches of the federal government applying the principle of the Dred Scott case to circumstances quite removed from anything in the Dred Scott case. The Democrats still do this thing. We did the Chadha case on the legislative veto. And they keep passing it. The Democrats have kept confining the holding in the charter case to an immigration case. They refuse to act on the principle. So the curious thing, why is it that the liberals understand the Lincolnian position and the conservatives recoil from it? If by the logic of this Constitution, I can't see that Lincoln could be anything other than right on this matter.
Professor Barnett.
Hi. This has been I think I speak on behalf of all of us. This was a memorable and just an amazing performance by both of you.
Wow. Really?
And I find myself in the position of agreeing with you both. So here, let me offer a way of reconciling what I think are the true strongest arguments made by each side, and maybe a way that will even satisfy Judge Griffith. the strongest argument Hadley makes, and it's the one I'm in complete agreement with, and that is there are such things as natural rights. I've written about them, and I agree with these rights in the same terms that Hadley does, and I agree with him fully. The strongest argument that Alex has is that Stephen Reinhardt should not be put in charge of deciding what those rights are.
I'll vote for that.
So we're both in agreement about these things, right? So now what do we do? So what if there's a way of actually accomplishing both at the same time? So for example, you take a doctrine like the presumption of constitutionality. Well, that's nowhere in the Constitution. There's no such thing as a presumption of constitutionality
exactly
there.
Right. Exactly
so do you going to adopt that, or are you going to adopt another presumption, say a presumption of liberty, in which the presumption of constitutionality is that, you know, when it's a dispute between the liberty of an individual and the constitutionality of restriction on liberty, well, the tie goes to the legislature. Or you could adopt the opposite presumption, a presumption of liberty, if there's a conflict between the liberty of the individual, the natural rights of the individual, and the restriction on that liberty by the legislature, then the burden's on the legislature to show that.
Exactly.
And what it would take to meet that burden would, for example, at the federal level, you'd have to show that it was a necessary and proper exercise of an enumerated power, or at the state level, that it was a necessary and proper exercise of a police power properly construed. You would have to have a theory of the police power, but that's something you have to have anyway. Now, what you have is, without letting judges or authorizing judges to speculate about any liberty whatsoever or any right whatsoever, you just talk about liberty in general. Of course, there's no liberty to commit murder. There's no liberty to commit robbery. We all know that. Everybody knows that. But once you're beyond that, and the question is, you're not talking about that sort of liberty, that sort of freedom, you're talking about a real liberty, then the question is whether the laws are justified or not. You don't have to speculate on the nature of man and the nature of rights.
Right.
You just
right.
have to
F-
speculate F- about, F- you just F- have right. to ask yourself, what is the justification for this restriction, and does it make sense? Is this a genuine health and safety measure, or is it an unreasonable, arbitrary, and discriminatory act? It's something that judges do quite routinely in the case of protecting the freedom of speech, so we know they can do it when they want to do it, and why can't they just do it for liberty generally? And wouldn't that really accommodate both positions, and maybe in a way that would satisfy Judge Griffith?
Well, you've described what is my position. In my chapter, Beyond the Constitution.
They were seen talking beforehand.
Notice all the time I was speaking, Randy's lips were never moving. Look, with that criticism of the first Congress by Sedgwick, I said, you could add to the inventory my right not to be stopped in my car and have my luggage searched without justification, my right not to have blood removed from my arm after an accident, my right not to be searched at the airport. We could keep adding to the inventory. But in each case, the thing will turn on without justification, which means at every turn, it's going to hinge on those principles of justification, and that's where the argument is, right? And we don't have to argue about the state of nature, right? Exactly.
Let me pretend that I'm Robbie George for a second.
We heard the sound of this practical reasonableness.
That's
right. That set off tremors.
So, okay. So Professor George points out that there's nothing in the natural law that tells us whether these decisions should be made by legislatures or judges, and you alluded to that a little bit.
I think so. Yeah, that's quite tenable. We could construe this system another way. But look, our friend John Walker, the Second Circuit, John argued that, when judges can act unconstitutionally, they can treat as trivial the restraints of conditions of a standing to sue, simply take it as a facial challenge right away, and essentially give their opinions about the decision, converting themselves into a third house of the legislature, right? We say, of course, we have all these arrangements that arise distinctly from the logic of this Constitution, of why we wanted what the judges should not rush to take these things in their hands right away, and should, while they're holding their hands, the decisions are left in the hands of elected representatives. I mean, this is a natural law argument. The natural law argument, it gives way. It's quite consonant with this structure for doing things.
Do you see any other?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hi, my name is Stephen Wallach. I'm from New York. As a litigator, I wonder how to advocate using natural law. I'll try to cite your book.
If nothing else works, try that.
Right. what other sources should I use?
On appeal.
Should I hire, say, Roger Scruton or Peter Singer as expert witnesses? What do you recommend?
Just be sure to put in the questions presented.
You do it the way judges, I think, used to do it. So when George Sutherland sees this law on the minimum wage in the District of Columbia for the sake of sustaining the morals of women, he said, so apparently if you work in a mercantile establishment as a woman, it's going to take $16 a week to preserve your morality. But if you work as a beginner in a laundry, you can do it for $9. Right? You begin to raise the old questions of, how do you know this? What's the principle behind this? Or the hot oil case. You know, the president can bar the 1,000th barrel of oil in Montana, but the 950th in Iowa. Say, how did you get this? Where did you get this standard? What's the principle? Has this thing been gone through hearings in Congress where people have faced this question? You simply raise anew the old question. What's the ground of principle on which you are going to establish this standard and impose it on the rest of us? It's a familiar. I just had a shock. I saw my face on television.
Don't worry, it's only going to be on cable.
As Tom Malyatsi says, I have a face made for radio.
I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
I'm Clark Forsyth with Americans United for Life, and my question's for Hadley. Hadley, I wonder if your superstructure and deep principles threatens to overwhelm, say, the original 10 of the 14th Amendment. If in the 1860s abortion was a state issue, a state criminal issue, and there's nothing in the historical record that the framers of the 14th Amendment intended to, in a sense, federalize it, why does natural law compel it to be federalized and brought within the 14th Amendment?
Well, I'm not alone in this. You know our friend Robbie George and others have made it. I think the 14th Amendment was protecting persons, right? So now the question is, what's the ground on which you're removing these human beings from the circle of those beings you think have a claim to the protections of the law? That's it. Look, I raised the question also with Scalia about original intent. We know Lyman Trumbull was telling people at the time that nothing in that 14th Amendment was going to challenge those laws on Illinois as well as Virginia that barred marriage across racial lines. And if he couldn't give those assurances at the time, people sensed that amendment didn't have a ghost of a chance of passing. So I raised the question with him, does that mean that you were improvident in taking Loving versus Virginia? He said, well, maybe we have to think about that. I don't think he would rethink that matter. And if he doesn't rethink that matter, we say that was the original understanding that formed the 14th Amendment. But perhaps Lyman Trumbull didn't understand the full implications of the very principles he was articulating. He said he did.
Huh? He said he did. He gave assurances. He says this will never be construed to empower the races to marry each other.
That's right.
I mean, he said that. That was a representation.
I know. But now we can come back and say, you know, it's not a knock on him.
He was wrong.
Huh?
He was wrong.
He was wrong. And we come back now.
And people who believed him, too bad for them. Yeah.
There you go. There's my answer.
We have time for one more question.
You know, Reinhard would love you. This.
Huh? What?
No, I think you and Reinhard would get along just fine.
We have one more question.
That's the worst thing you said to me today.
I've been signaled. This is the last
My name is Justin Schubaum. I'm speaking in my personal capacity. This question is for Professor Arcus. Which of the competing natural law theories would you advise us to accept? That of Aquinas, Hobbes, Locke, Plato, if you thought one, he had one, Aristotle, if you think he had one, Kant, if you think he had one. And furthermore, do you think under natural law it's permissible to have a law permitting artificial contraception?
I'm not going to reach the question of transvestites either today, or other things. The founders were quite clear in rejecting Hobbes. Hobbes saying that the desires and passions of men are themselves no sin until they know a law which forbids them, which till laws be made they cannot know. No one can afford to assume that everyone out there was going to be subject to moral restraints until laws were made. And Hamilton says, this view holds that all morality is conventional, that even when governments break down, there is no morality, and that is utterly at odds with this. Now, what I do is I try to draw from the traditions that I think are most sensible that I can put together. Draw from Kant what I think is, I can't draw anything from Hobbes, I'm afraid. I'll just try to put them together with those I think that are consonant with the best teachings given to us by the founders. So I'll just have to plead for that and invite you to read the fuller account in my book. The only thing I could say, my books, I guess I could end with a reworking of Woody Allen's line and say that there is no doubt that there is a moral world out there and natural law. The only question is, how far is it from Midtown? How late does it stay open?
Thank you very much. If you'll join me in thanking our guests.